The MLB Home Run Derby continues. So far, Junior Caminero is the leader in the clubhouse with 21 homers. Brent Rooker hit 17. James Wood hit 16. O'Neill Cruz just finished up hitting 21 home runs as well, including one he hit 488 feet. It's tied for the longest Derby home run of the StatCast era, which began in 2016. Outside of Coors Field, obviously, in Colorado, which in 2017, Aaron Judge hit one 513 feet out there in Denver. It's absolutely nuts. So, not that, you know, does anybody ultimately
probably not
care that much?
Not quite as hard to hit it that far when you're in Colorado.
Not when you're a mile up there. The air's a little thinner.
Probably not flies quite. A little far. I mean, it's still impressive, but like, you want to do that somewhere that's a lot closer to the ocean? Okay, yeah, I get that. You hit 500 anywhere else? Hit 500 anywhere else? I respect.
Yeah, I mean, 488 feet in Atlanta to me is more impressive than
really,
513 feet in Colorado.
That's really impressive.
I would say. After hours here on 96.5 The Fan, Logan Weber alongside Chris Unocero. We're with you for another hour here until 9 o'clock on this Monday, and Chris, I kind of want to talk about this bizarre story that came out today about Teddy Bridgewater. I don't know if you saw this.
Oh, yeah.
So Teddy Bridgewater, you know, has been a longtime NFL quarterback, primarily as a backup coming out of the University of Louisville, right? He was a high draft pick, but
man,
never.
I wanted the Chiefs to draft him.
Yeah, never. He never really came to fruition in the league. He was out of the NFL entirely last year.
Until the end of last year.
Yeah, until the Lions were like, hey, why don't you come be our backup quarterback in like week 15? And Teddy's like, yeah, sure, I guess so. And then he ended up having to like go in for a drive. And I think it was the divisional round game against the Commanders. Now, it didn't last. It was like one play. He gave a handoff to Jameson Williams, who took it to the barn. And then Jared Goff was right back in the game. But Bridgewater is now back out of the NFL now, and he is back coaching. He was a volunteer coach at Miami Northwestern down in Florida. It was announced today that he was suspended by Miami Northwestern for providing, quote, impermissible benefits to his players. Now, this suspension did not come from the state or any other organization, you know, in the air. It came directly from the high school. Mind you, this is the high school that he himself went to. He was the coach for Miami Northwestern last year. They won a Class 3A state championship in his first year. And now they are alleging that he was paying for things for his players. Camps and physical therapy treatments and all these other things. And because of that, he was suspended. He was helping his players attend camps, helping them pay for equipment that they couldn't otherwise afford, helping them get, you know, physical therapy services and doctor's appointments and things that maybe they otherwise couldn't afford. And he's being punished for it. Well done, Miami Northwestern. Way to get the criminals off the street. We are doing a job here, aren't we? Wow. Unbelievable work by you guys.
I mean, you'd have to think this was something in regards to like some sort of rules or like, because usually like whenever there's a suspension like this, it's like, okay, we're doing this so that we don't get in trouble. Like, you'd have to think that was the case, but it's like, why would it ever be an issue that you are funding any sort of treatment, giving rides or paying for rides?
Yeah, like Uber rides and like meals for his kids.
Like this is the kind of issue that we had up until NIL got made available for players to get in college sports. And it was always stupid. Like, as you look at some of the cases where people would get in trouble or even suspended for improper benefits. And it was like, or one time, I think like there was a football player who ate too much spaghetti or something at some sort of team function and had to pay that back. Somebody used water from campus to wash their car and they had to pay for that. I mean, there's just a lot of ridiculous aspects to it. And it's like, look, man, the fact that we have made it so that we've tried to tell people it's a bad thing for athletes to get benefits for what they do is one of the things when we were younger, I think most of us were like, you hear a story about somebody getting improper benefits and they get suspended. Like, oh yeah, they broke the rules. You should get suspended. But it's like, when you actually think about it critically, it's like, why is it a bad thing for these guys to get benefits for what they do? 'Cause like, any regular person, if you did your job or an activity and someone was like, hey, you're really good at this. Hey, how about I give you a free meal or this or that? Like, we wouldn't bat an eye. But when an athlete does it, all of a sudden it's a problem. Like, that part I've never understood. And the arguments I don't think have ever been very good. It's like, oh, well, it's a competitive balance thing. It's like, when have things ever been fair between, like, the bigger and smaller schools? Like, the bigger schools always use their advantages to get players that the smaller schools want but can't get. Like, I say this as a Florida fan. I guarantee you Florida has been doing things under the table to try to get players before NIL, because all these schools were doing.
Everybody.
And I don't care. Like, the story about Cam Newton's dad shopping him around for 100 racks, I believe it. And I don't care. Like, if that's what the price was to get him to come play for Auburn, I'm cool with it. Because that's what it is. Like, the idea that these guys shouldn't be able to use their talents to get benefits, to me, has always been ridiculous. If a coach wants to pay money out of his or her own pocket to help their players be able to perform better, be able to get to the places they need to be able to have a roof over their head or have food or whatever, I don't see a problem.
No.
It's his money. He can do with it whatever the hell he wants to.
Exactly. And you know, the thing for me is, and not to get into the weeds of this particular situation, but just look up Miami Northwestern High School. Like, it is smack dab in Miami. It's like right up against Liberty City in Miami. I mean, this is an incredibly underserved community in Miami and in regards to the entire United States. He's providing rides for kids whose parents might not be able to afford gas to get them to practice.
Or even have a car.
Or a car in general. He's providing meals for kids that may not know where their next one is coming from. And we're going to penalize him. We're gonna reprimand this individual for trying to change and better these young people's lives. This feels like the wrong thing to be taking a stand for. But
like I said, I think it's a preventative thing because they're worried about getting in trouble, because I know that Florida has been a little wonky about like handing out benefits to the students anyways, which is the reason why now the politicians are trying to change some of those rules, mm-hmm. because it's hurt some of the D1 colleges, the Power Four colleges like Florida, Miami, Florida State in recruiting, because they haven't been able to keep up with other states that are a little bit more lax as far as players getting paid and benefits and whatnot. So I can understand that part. But at the same time, it's like, maybe you should focus your efforts on trying to change the rules that disadvantage you rather than going out there and trying to play by them when they're really not good rules. Like, I just think that this is very counterproductive. And at the end of the day, I think it really does shine a light on some of the issues that we have in college and high school sports. Because again, it's like, I've been, you know, as I said earlier, is like, I really do feel like these athletes don't get treated like regular people. And I understand like money and fame and notoriety and all that, but they're still people too. And I think if we were all in their position, we would want to get the same kind of treatment that the average citizen gets treated with. If we all had talents that we could monetize on the way that those athletes could, we would sure as hell like to get the same benefits that a regular person would. And it sucks that these people get punished simply because there are people above them that don't want them to get those benefits.
And just trying to be a good person, I guess. And like Miami Northwest, it's a public school. Like, so is there, you know, or is there problems or concerns about him recruiting players at a public school? Seems incredibly unlikely. Somebody in the text line said, I don't see the difference between him helping his players financially with food or rides or physical therapies, equipment, what have you, and a teacher who's helping a student by getting them school supplies or a new pair of shoes, right?
Exactly.
You don't hear about teachers being reprimanded for those sorts of actions. This is a player or a coach trying to better the lives of his players. Yeah, whatever. And he's a volunteer coach. Like, that's one of the crazier parts of this whole. It's like he's volunteering his time to do this. He's taking no money from the school district, and he's doing this on top of it.
And
you're reprimanding him.
He's giving his own money.
That's insane.
His own money. He's not using school funds. He's giving his own money. And that's a problem. And it wouldn't shock me if one of these other coaches out there snitched on him.
Or threatened
to snitch on him.
Right.
I think they self-reported. I think he reported this to the school, and that's where it's like, it wouldn't shock me if one of these other coaches is out here snitching or threatening to snitch, and that's what happened. And it's just like my thing is like, there's a lot of haters out there that are willing to go to great lengths to get rid of the competition there.
Get that man out of there.
Yeah.
Won a state title.
I would tell you this. I hope Teddy Bridgewater is able to get out of this with no issues. I hope he definitely takes this for his coaching career further, gets into college, because he seems like a really good dude. And I think college football needs more really good dudes as college coaches.
913-586-7965 is our number. We're going to take a break, come back. We'll continue to update you on the MLB Home Run Derby. So that 488-foot home run that O'Neill Cruz hit, that was the first report that I got. It was 513 feet. So he hit one 513 feet in Atlanta.
Okay, that's definitely more impressive than the one.
My God, 513 in Atlanta is nuts. We'll talk more about that on the other side. You're listening to After Hours, Logan Weber and Chris Unocero here on 96.5 The Fan.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks, Eats, Drinks, Scenic Views, on your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan.
Just reading Twitter right now. Chaz Chisholm, not impressive at the home run derby.
Oh, the haters are having a day right now. They got two home runs.
The haters are out in full force.
He's on a break right now, getting his little Gatorade on and whatnot, or whatever, whoever sponsored the official drink of the home run derby.
How much time does he have left?
Oh, he's about to start back up here. I'm a passing fan of the home run derby right now. I usually am every year. I don't care about it, but I do like to watch it. But I don't remember the format because it feels like they change it every year. He's got three home runs. He's in the bonus round. He's got three outs left. He's got three home runs. That's it. I mean, and mind you, like, the next closest person to him is whoever Wood is. He's got 16.
Yeah, James Wood of the Nationals with 16.
Yeah, he's got 16.
Yeah, Buxton hit 20. Brent Rooker hit 17. Yeah. Caminero and O'Neill Cruz each hit 21.
Yeah.
And this man's got three.
He's got three. He's got two outs left now with three whole-ass home runs.
So maybe the guy who only hit 16 home runs during the first half of the year is not the guy that you throw into the home run derby at the last second. There's 29 fan bases in Major League Baseball.
One out left now with three home runs.
Oh my God. The home run derby, the memes right now are insane. I just saw one that said Jazz Chisholm's home run derby highlights, and it's Aaron Rodgers coming out of the tunnel with the American flag.
He just hit his fourth one here. No, that's an out. Is that an out or is that a home run? That is an out.
Still shocked that Jazz Chisholm willingly joined this.
I mean, he got in. At least he got to be on the field. You know, it's like, I mean, at least he got that accomplished. He could say he was a part of the home run derby. But yeah, never again.
Yeah,
that was three Three? Yeah, that's embarrassing.
Bartolo Colon would have had more home runs in the home run derby than Jazz Chisholm.
I think he might have.
Damn.
I honestly think he might have.
That's a tough one. That's a tough one to swallow there, man. Yeah, that is not at all ideal.
That was a good call from the haters.
I want to go back to the text line here really quick because we were talking about the Teddy Bridgewater situation, and somebody in the text line said, you know, it's state high school sports. In spirit, yes, it should be allowed and it should be fine, but by rule, no. And then they mentioned the Pembroke Hill state basketball thing that happened a few years ago here in Missouri. No, I shouldn't say a few years ago. It was back in, 2000, where, you know, the Rush brothers had went to Pembroke Hill and they ended up having like three state titles, I think, stripped 97, 98, 99. There's a distinct difference, I think, between that situation and this situation with Teddy Bridgewater. It doesn't sound to me as if Teddy Bridgewater was paying these guys to play on his football team. They were on his football team, and he was paying for their meals and for rides and for equipment. The Rush brothers, according to the report and why Misha stepped forward and stripped the titles and why there was like a huge lawsuit and like their AAU coach went to jail and a bunch of crazy stuff, they got paid to play on an AAU team and got paid to be a part of Pembroke Hill. It's a very different situation, in my view. Now, if money's exchanged, you know, does it matter what the circumstances are? By rule, by law, maybe not. But I think that is an important detail that should not be omitted from this situation.
Here's the thing. According to Jordan Schultz, here's what Bridgewater personally covered out of his own pocket. $14,000 for training camp, $9,500 for team pride sets, which obviously...
Which the training camp was for the entire team.
Right.
That $14,000 was for the entire team to go through that training camp.
$2,200 a week for pregame meals, $1,300 a week for recovery, which if it's $1,300 a week, I mean, I would assume it's a trainer to make sure these guys are good, you know, massages, things like that. $700 a week for Ubers, which if you know how Ubers work, that's not going to take you that far for that many players. And that's what he's being penalized for. He's not handing out cars to these kids. He's not handing out cash to these kids. He is paying to sustain his football program so that they can win. That's completely different than being paid to play on a team.
Completely different.
Especially for an underfunded team. Because I guarantee you this, you go to some of those nicer districts in more affluent areas, I guarantee you they also have money that's flowing in from a lot of donors to help those programs get the things that they need. A lot of these programs now, they very much rely on people making donations, on fundraising and things like that. I guarantee you there are people out there, like parents whose kids play sports, who have to hear about fundraisers all the time because their school needs money to pay for uniforms, for camps, for equipment, for food, etc. And to have a head coach that can just do that out of his own pocket without needing to fundraise, especially in an underprivileged area, that's not the same thing as the Pembroke Hill situation.
Not even close. I mean, I just go back when I was in high school, we had, you know, my small little high school up in the north part of the metro. We had an organization, it was called Band of Mothers, and they would take, you know, donations and things, and they would feed us on Friday nights before our football games, right? They would spaghetti or, you know, chicken out, whatever, some kind of pasta or pizza, or sometimes it was just like a crazy amount of sandwiches or something, whatever it was, but they fed us every Friday, or they would give us these little like go bags when we would have away games and what have you. How is that any different than what Teddy Bridgewater was doing? Except for Teddy Bridgewater was the organization. He's just taking care of his players. I don't think this is in any way, shape or form the same situation as somebody who is paying somebody for a service, trying to pay a player in high school to come play for your team. That's not what this was. He wasn't handing out $1,000 or tens of thousands of dollars to these guys to go spend on whatever. He was giving them rides home, rides to practice. He was feeding them.
He's not out here paying for Ferraris for these kids. He's paying for necessities, for uniforms, for treatment, for rides, for food.
It's not the same thing.
Not the same thing. And again, I just see no issue with it.
I don't either.
And it's just weird to me that we have that situation there. But then you have these schools all around the country that are, a lot of them are like private schools that can essentially pay kids to go play there. They can either offer them free rides and they can have a nice homestay type situation mm-hmm. with the family that's affluent, can pay for everything. And that's no problem. But the minute the coach wants to come out of pocket to help support his kids, that's a problem.
Yeah. They're where they've drawn the line here makes little to no sense. 913-586-7965. When we come back, I want to go through an interesting little exercise. So over the weekend, I saw a TikTok which tried to put together the Mount Rushmore, for Mizzou football. So I kind of want to go through, okay, who are the top four players in your opinion, in our opinion, Chris, in the history of Mizzou football, KU football, K-State football? We're going to do that coming up next here on After Hours. Logan Weber alongside Chris Unocero, 96.5 The Fan, your home for Kansas City sports.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan.
And poor Jazz Chisholm. Rough go for the young man.
Ain't no poor nothing.
I mean, fair.
He didn't perform.
Yeah, I don't feel bad necessarily. But
he got what happened. When you are, it's like this. If you go to the dunk contest and you can't dunk, that's a problem. Like, it's as simple as that. Yeah. You go to a home run derby and you can't hit home runs. Well, if you get booed, you get booed. That's what it is.
When anybody with eyes and a brain recognizes that the only reason that you're in the position of making the All-Star game in the home run derby is because your manager is managing the American League in the All-Star game, and then you go out to the home run derby and you hit three home runs, you kind of got what's coming to you. He got booed, Chris, at Truist Park in Atlanta by the patrons attending the home run. They booed that man
when his time was up.
I mean, fair point. All right, I want to go through kind of an interesting exercise here. I mentioned it before the break that over the weekend I saw on social media somebody put together a Mount Rushmore list of Mizzou football players. And so I thought it would be kind of a fun exercise to go through the three area Division I FBS programs here, you know, in the Kansas City Metro, Mizzou, KU, K-State, and try to put together a Mount Rushmore list. Mizzou was the one that I saw, so I want to hold off on that one and do that one last. Let's start with K-State. If I'm looking at a Mount Rushmore list of the best players in K-State football history, I'll start with Darren Sproles, probably. You know, played at K-State from 01 to 04. He was an All-American. He finished top five in the Heisman Trophy voting in, I believe, 2003. And at his size, you know, 5'6", guy was incredibly undersized for the position. He is still the program's all-time leader, I believe, in rushing yards, despite how good Deuce Vaughn was over that couple years that he was there. I think Darren Sproles is probably on your Mount Rushmore list if you're a K-State fan, for what he provided. And then to go on to the NFL and have the career that he did with the Chargers and the Eagles and stick around as long as he did, I think Darren Sproles is firmly on a Mount Rushmore if you're a K-State fan.
Yeah, I think that one's easy. I think if we're doing like first round pick for them, yeah, Darren Sproles for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Michael Bishop is another guy.
Yeah, he was for real. He was for real as quarterback there, late 90s or early 2000s. Yeah, he was real good.
Yeah, he won the Davey O'Brien Award. He finished second in the Heisman Trophy voting in 1998, which I believe is still the highest finish ever for a K-State Wildcat. So I've got him on there. Tyler Lockett, another one. Phenomenal career. He was a two-time All-American, two-time first-team All-Big 12. He was Big 12 Offensive Player of the Year his senior year in 2014 and has gone on to have a pretty long NFL career as well with the Seattle Seahawks. I think Tyler Lockett belongs on that list.
Yeah. For me, for K-State, Bishop, obviously, Darren Sproles. Tyler Lockett, Terrence Newman.
Terrence Newman. That was another name that I was floating around. I like the idea of Terrence Newman. I floated around the idea of Jordy Nelson as well.
Lockett was a little bit better than Nelson at K-State. He had a couple thousand yards, like a 1,200 and 1,500 yard season. Nelson really just broke out his junior year, mm-hmm. So that was the reason why.
Yeah, I would have to probably agree with you when it came to Terrence Newman. He was Jim Thorpe Award winner. He was an All-American. He was an All-Big 12 guy in the return game as well. So he was kind of a multifaceted player for the K-State Wildcats. And I think that kind of goes with the theme of kind of the glory years of K-State football under Bill Snyder. You know, you've got starting in 1997 with Michael Bishop, and it goes up through Tyler Lockett in 2014. So all of it kind of in that 17-year time frame between the late 90s to the mid to 2010s, so to speak, when K-State football
somebody's
was
trying to make a case
peak.
For Skylar. Look, Skylar's real good. Man, Michael Bishop was different when he was the quarterback there. And I don't know who you would I couldn't put Skylar over Terrence Newman because Terrence Newman was a great DB when he was at K-State. Like everyone who watched him at K-State was like, okay, he's going to be a great DB in the NFL. And,
yeah.
And he was. So Skylar's real good, but I can't put him above anybody else that's on the list.
No, I'm sorry. If I'm having to put another quarterback on the list from K-State, I'm probably putting Colin Klein on that list before I'm putting Skylar Thompson on that list.
I would put Klein over Thompson.
Yeah, he had a great.
Too.
Yeah, he's K-State's all-time leader in passing yards. He was a three-year, four-year starter for K-State. That's all well and good. 7,100 passing yards. You know, 42 touchdowns, 16 picks. That's great. But he didn't have the high highs that you know Colin Klein or Bishop had.
Bishop. He was for real when he was there at K-State. He was for real. He was one of the biggest reasons why I rooted for K-State back in the 90s because I was like this dude's really fun to watch play.
He was crazy. In the late 90s, to be a dual threat quarterback of that nature in college football was sort of still a pretty new thing.
Oh, there were a lot of them. It was just like for him in conjunction with all the talent that they had, because like in the 90s they were. Like the Big 12, man, that was a league back in the 90s, man.
Yeah.
Like them and the Huskers and like Mizzou was pretty good. KU was pretty good in the 90s as well. That was the conference back then. And Oklahoma, obviously. Yeah, no, Big 12 was really nice back in the late 90s.
I'm not gonna lie. I was with you all the way up until the point where you started complimenting the University of Nebraska, and then you lost
me. Nebraska was great.
I don't care.
They were great.
Before I was born.
Eric Crouch. Oh,
you sound
man.
Like every Nebraska fan I went to college with. I don't want to hear it.
Eric Crouch. Oh man, he was real fun to watch.
Yeah, I'm sure he was. All right, let's go to K-State's Mount Rushmore now. KU. There's a very obvious number one for the Jayhawks. Let's all say it together in unison. It's Gale Sayers.
Yeah.
I mean, he's obviously the first guy that goes on the list at K-State. Yeah, I mean, he was absolutely unbelievable. The Kansas Comet, as he was later called, you know, inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. His numbers retired. He was a consensus All-American twice, first team All-Big Eight three times. He is very much considered the best player in the history of KU football.
I don't think there's any dispute in that. No.
All right. The second player that I have on my list, and I keep going back and forth on this one. I really do. Aqib Talib.
He's on my list.
I mean,
Aqib was for real, and he was very underrated coming out of KU. But he was a guy I really liked coming out of there in the draft, and it was no shocker that he was really good for Denver and other teams. Like he was very, very tough there. No, Aqib Talib. No, I 100% agree with that.
I mean, he was a part of that team, a huge part of that team that went to the Orange Bowl in 2007. He was an All-American, first team All Big 12 twice. He was a freshman All-American. You know, 13 picks in his career. He was also an outstanding return man at points in his career. And to date, he is the last KU Jayhawk to be drafted in the first round. 2008. Prior to that, Dana Stubblefield in 1993. Last guy in the 30 plus years that have gone since to be drafted in the first round by KU. He belongs on my list, I have to say.
Yeah, same here. Yeah, no, Keeb Tlaib was another. He was another no-brainer.
All right. Third guy I've got, John Hadle. I mean, guy that was a remarkable two-way player at KU. Not only was he the quarterback and an All-American quarterback at Kansas twice, he had the longest punt in school history. And in fact, led the nation in average yards per punt in 1959, after being a first-team All-Big Eight running back in 1959. He became an All-American quarterback in 1960 and 1961, which is nuts. He also played DB and had the longest interception return in school history until Aqib Talib broke that in 2007. And he's a member of the College Football Hall of Fame.
Yeah, no, I agree with that one as well. Hadle, yeah. I mean, anytime you got a guy who's College Football Hall of Fame, especially for a program like KU that doesn't have a whole lot of great success long term, yeah, no, I agree with that.
All right, here's the other one that the fourth one's the one that I've had the biggest trouble with. I've seen people say John Riggins.
Really?
And I understand it. I'm going to go with Todd Reesing.
Yeah, I think that's easy. He's the all-time passing leader in KU history.
Yeah, single season and career. Yeah. Pretty much everything at KU. 11,000 yards, 90 touchdowns.
3 years over like 3,400 passing yards.
Yeah.
The last time KU was like really great.
Yeah, led them to an Orange Bowl.
He was their guy. Yeah, no, it's like KU was great when he was the starting quarterback there. They were a great team. They were up. I mean, what were they, number two in the nation at one point?
Yep.
Against Mizzou? Yeah. No, he definitely deserves to be there.
I would agree. Somebody said Gilbert Brown. I can't say I'm very familiar with Gilbert Brown. I know he played for like the Packers, wasn't it, at one point in his career? Played alongside Dana Stubblefield. If you're going to throw a guy on the list, it's probably Stubblefield, not Gilbert Brown. But, you know, I digress. All right, now let's go through Mizzou here real quick before we take our final break tonight. Obviously, one is Chase Daniel. I mean, took Mizzou from a program that people had heard about to a level of national prominence that they have maybe never seen before or since. At one point, they were the number one team in the country after they beat Oklahoma and then ended up losing the very next week, and it came, you know, kind of crashing down. But they were a national championship contender at one point, right? He was a Heisman Trophy finalist. He was a Davey O'Brien finalist. He was absolutely remarkable, helping the Tigers win 12 games that year and was the Big 12's Offensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, the best Mizzou's ever been in my lifetime was when Chase Daniel was their starting quarterback. So, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, that I'll never forget that 08 season watching Mizzou at the beginning of the year, because I grew up in the Metro. I'm an Iowa fan, but all my friends were Mizzou fans. We used to go over to a buddy of mine's house and watch Mizzou games every Saturday. And watching that two-game stretch against, I think it was Nevada and SEMO, where he had more touchdown passes than incompletions over those two games. Yeah, I know that it's Nevada and SEMO, but more touchdowns than incompletions is nuts. Chase Daniel belongs on the list.
That was my freshman year at Mizzou. I'm a Florida fan, so they gave me flack because they were like, they were talking up Mizzou real big. Obviously, Mizzou got humbled later on, especially when they played Texas.
Yeah.
And I remember that year. That was a year where they were feeling, especially because the year before they were number one in the nation going into the Big 12 title game. Obviously they got that ass whooped by the Sooners, but they definitely were a team to look out for in the Big 12 that 08 year. Chase Daniel was really good.
He was a dog. Second guy I've got on the Mount Rushmore for Mizzou is Kellen Winslow Sr.
Easy.
Kind of a pretty easy one.
That's a gimme right there. Yeah, he's one of the best tight ends to ever play the game.
Yeah. Not only was he a great college player, he's one of only two Mizzou Tigers football players ever to be put into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Yep. Completely revolutionized what it meant to be a tight end, both at the college level and at the NFL level. The last two are difficult because I think there's a handful of guys you can throw in there. Johnny Rowland is a guy you can discuss. Justin Smith, Jeremy Macklin, Roger Worley, right there. Brad Smith, even, you know, I remember watching Brad Smith as a young kid. And, you know, I was a slight Mizzou fan there for a little while, watching Brad Smith play the quarterback position, ended up becoming a receiver in the NFL, which was fascinating. But I think that I'll probably throw Justin Smith and Jeremy Macklin on that Mount Rushmore, right? Chase Daniel was phenomenal, but is Chase Daniel Chase Daniel without having a running mate like Jeremy Maclin to throw the football to? Those two were such a match made in heaven for that Tigers offense. And Justin Smith, from the word go, from the moment that dude stepped on campus, he was a phenomenal player. He was big, you know, Big 12 freshman of the year. He had freshman All-American still holds the school record, I believe, for sacks in a career. And in fact, you know, his last year at Mizzou had 11 sacks, 24 TFLs, 97 total tackles as a junior. Did all of that in 3 years. I would throw Justin Smith on my Mount Rushmore if I'm a Mizzou person.
Yeah, for sure. Jeremy Maclin. There's three Smiths you could throw in there. You can have Justin Smith. You can have Brad Smith. You can have Alden Smith.
Yeah.
I would go Brad Smith just because it was like he was the player when I first started really getting into college football real big like that. He was the first like great Mizzou quarterback I remember. So yeah, no, he and not only that, but like he was legitimately like one of the best college quarterbacks out there. Just he was never going to get a chance because he was not like an elite passer, but he made up for that with his running. So he didn't quite get his just due, but yeah, great player.
No, he was fun to watch, man. I mean,
yeah, really fun to watch. I mean, you know, I Florida fan, but yeah, he definitely was entertaining to watch. I always appreciated quarterbacks that had athleticism.
And again, kind of kicked off that golden era of Mizzou football there for a while. You know, Brad Smith at the quarterback position followed that up with Chase Daniel. And then was it James Franklin Chase Daniel?
I think it was like one guy and then James.
Yeah. And then you had the Matty Mock era, which we won't speak of. 913.
Man, they thought he was going to be so
They thought he was going to be him, dude.
He was bad.
913-586-7965 is our number. We'll come back and wrap up our show here on this Monday night after hours. Logan Weber alongside Chris Unocero, your home for Kansas City sports.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports. 96.5, The Fan.
I have an apology to make. We were trying to figure out, there was a guy between Chase Daniel and James Franklin. It was Blaine Gabbert. Somebody said a
you
guy
don't have
after
to apologize
that,
for
how
him.
How could you forget about Chiefs legend Blaine Gabbert?
Yeah, you don't have to apologize for him.
Chiefs legend is strong. I do remember.
Blaine Gabbert is overrated.
I do remember Blaine Gabbert. I distinctly remember that man losing the 2010 Insight Bowl. Who'd they lose to? Oh, that's right. Iowa Hawkeyes.
Blaine Gabbert was overrated. We don't have to talk about him. He should never have been drafted in the first round.
Fair point.
He only got drafted in the first round because he was big.
Fair. I mean, that's just kind of been a consensus with Mizzou quarterbacks. You know, Chase Daniel was probably drafted too high. Blaine Gabbert was drafted too high. Drew Locke was drafted too high. You know, those guys had great college careers, just didn't pan out in the big leagues. What are the rules to the home run derby anymore? Like, you remember when guys used to tie and there used to be like a swing off? Apparently we don't do that anymore. Cal Raleigh and Brent Rooker tied with 17 home runs apiece, meaning that one of them was advancing to the semifinals, the other wasn't. Cal Raleigh got the nod because the longest home run that he hit went 470.61 feet. Rooker's longest home run went 470.53 feet. So two home runs separated by less than an inch put Cal Raleigh into the semifinals and not Brent Rooker. What happened to the home run derby I love? You've got guys hitting three home runs, and then we're getting tape measures out to determine who moves on to the next round instead of just having those two guys duke it out in a batter's box.
It's okay. It's the home run derby.
I don't like it. It doesn't count. I can't watch it anymore. I can't.
It does. Just don't place any value on the result. Just enjoy the fact that they're hitting the ball very far.
Chris, stop trying to talk reason to me, all right? Because I don't want it. That'll do it for our program here tonight, After Hours. For my producer, Chris Unocero, I'm Logan Weber. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for getting involved in the text line, as always. After Hours back tomorrow. It's going to be Bink with you from 6 to 9 o'clock here during All-Star Week of Major League Baseball. We out. 96.5 The Fan.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports. 96.5 The Fan.